Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Kay from Greenlight, and we're thrilled to host tonight's event with Leah Conan, launching her new book, The Perfect Escape. She will be talking with Andrea Bartz. We got the poster, we got the book. So you're in for an excellent time. Got it all. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Leah and to Andrea and the team at GP Putnam's for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. Although we're not able to host events in our store spaces, our community of authors and readers is still here. We're grateful for your support and for the chance to make space for conversation and connection. And importantly, tonight's featured book, The Perfect Escape, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. You can shop in person from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. at both our Fulton Street and Flatbush Ave stores, where you can purchase Leah's book and many others on site. You can also order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S. And lastly, Leah is stopping by our store to sign copies of the book, so you can get a signed book by request while supplies last. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. Our interviewer tonight is Andrea Bartz, a Brooklyn-based journalist and the New York Times bestselling author of We Were Never Here, The Lost Night, and The Herd. Her work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Marie Claire, Vogue, and many other outlets, and she's held editorial positions at Glamour, Psychology Today, and Self, among other publications. She will be speaking with our featured author, Leah Conan. Conan is a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where she studied journalism and English literature. Her debut thriller, All the Broken People, was a Rolling Stone, Marie Claire, She Reads, and Charlotte Observer Best Summer Book Pick. She's also the author of several young adult novels, including Love and Other Trainwrecks and The Romantics. She lives in Brooklyn and Saugerties, New York, with her husband, their daughter, Eleanor, and their dog, Farley. Leah's new book, The Perfect Escape, is a twisty, unforgettable thriller about a perfect girl's weekend gone deadly, which Book Page described as having a delicious, unhinged energy. Leah is going to start us off with a reading from the book, and then she'll be talking with Andrea and with all of you. Please take it away, Leah and Andrea.
First, I just want to say thank you so much to Greenlight, and seriously, get the book, get your signed copy from Greenlight, because that is the best way to keep all of this amazing stuff going, especially during the pandemic when it is so incredibly difficult to make all of this work. So seriously, just a huge thank you to them for hosting. I'm just going to read quickly from a few chapters in of this book. Basically, The Perfect Escape is a book about three friends who go on a trip. They're headed to the Adirondacks, and halfway to their destination, the car breaks down and they find themselves in a town that they were not supposed to be in. And one of our main characters actually realizes that her ex, who she was trying to get some space from on this weekend, actually lives in this town. So this is kind of the chapter of her putting all of this together. At first, I hadn't even realized it. I'd gone into the gas station, read my mom's text, and hadn't had a clue. But once the key was gone, once we started to talk about staying the night, once I really gave Google Maps a good look, there it was. Catskill, New York. It was a quaint little town, not as built up as Woodstock or Kingston, a sweet mountain destination that lost residents and all its businesses sometime in the 70s, like so many of these towns did. Only starting to revitalize in the last few years, craft beer tasting rooms and fair trade coffee shops popping up like flowers breaking through the frost after a long winter. Population 11,000. Established in the 1770s, the former home of several New York State politicians and artists, a successful baseball player, and surprisingly, the place where Mike Tyson began his training in the 1980s. I knew all about Catskill. I'd spent too much time on its too short Wikipedia page, devouring every fact I could, or using Google Maps to walk myself up and down its streets, or actually walking up and down those streets, trying to understand, but that was only once, promise. It would be okay, I told myself, as we'd chosen rooms and opened a bottle of wine, as we'd settled on a nearby bar, Eamon's, for a very late dinner, as I let Diana do my makeup and run a flat iron over my hair, insistent that we make the most of our night out. Hell, maybe it'd be more than okay. Maybe this crazy trip would bring us together. Because Catskill, New York, the setting of our breakdown, wasn't just another upstate New York mountain town. It was where Harry lived now, where Harry lived with Elizabeth, the woman he left me for. It was nearly 10 by the time we arrived at Eamon's, a brutal, sweeping cinder block building with huge windows on one side. It must have been an old gas station or auto shop before. It was set off a small road, a few blocks from the main drag and surrounded by woods, half cool, half creepy. Diana led the way, striding confidently, Margaret right behind her. The air was balmy, almost wet, in that early May way that says summer is coming, stat. There was no bouncer, no one even checking IDs, but based on the number of cars in the dusty parking lot, the sound of voices bursting from inside and the cluster of people sharing smokes out front, it was anything but empty. I grabbed the ends of my hair, which felt glossy and blunt when straightened. Between that and Diana's insistence on a cat eye, I felt overly made up for this sort of place, like I was trying too hard. She would never try too hard. She didn't have to. So who's going to make out with the townie? Diana asked, turning to us and grinning mischievously. She ran a finger over the neckline of her slinky black dress. She looked fabulous. When in Rome, right? And we're looking fantastic, all things considered. No thanks, Margaret said. She wasn't the sort for public makeouts, and if I understood correctly, she hadn't been with anyone but Lars in over a decade. For my part, I forced a grin. Part of me wanted to, needed to. I had to shake off my grief, but the other part couldn't help but imagine. Diana turned away abruptly, tugging open the large wooden door. If I knew her, and I did, she'd be ordering trios of margaritas or tequila shots in minutes. She was a drink away your sorrows, drink away your stresses. The sort of woman. And though our hangouts almost always led to headaches the next morning, I didn't mind. There was something about the way her eyes locked on yours as she listened to all your problems. The way she knew how to say just the right thing, never dishing out advice, as Margaret sometimes tended to do, but just being there. That must be so hard. I'm so mad that happened to you. Of course you would feel that way. She was the glue of our group, even if I was the one who technically brought us together. She was 33, which put her smack dab in the middle of Margaret and me age-wise, and her easygoing, up-for-anything spirit was a perfect bridge between my reckless impulsivity and Margaret's careful planning. Inside, the bar was dark, hazy, and cavernous. Large cinder blocks rose high on one side, wood paneling on the other, and doors led off to side rooms, one holding a pool table, another a jukebox, the one in back leading to a hallway that headed who knows where. I couldn't help it. I found my head swiveling back and forth, looking. Even in the darkness, the blur of bodies and profiles, I struggled to spot a flash of Harry's silver hair or strong nose. He probably didn't even go out anymore, not with her. They probably made nice steaks at home and split fancy bottles of wine and had sex in the kitchen, that kind of thing. He probably didn't even think of me at all. Help you? I turned back to see the bartender, face illuminated by the glow of a hanging green glass lamp and a neon Pabst bar sign, his voice almost as scratchy as his beard. I didn't see it on the list, but can you do margaritas? Diana asked. Strong ones. Ding, ding, ding. Diana would go on Diana-ing, that was for sure. The bar's typical offerings, be damned. The guy gestured down the bar. The plastic edge of a blender glinted in the hazy light. If you can handle them, I can do it. Diana eyed us, as if waiting for one of us to stop her. Asked for a very adult glass of red wine. My treat, she said. Lord, Margaret said, we still have to drive tomorrow, you know. She glanced at Diana, right? Of course, Diana said, but tomorrow's still a long way away. When the margaritas arrived, because I couldn't help myself, because the two glasses of wine I'd had back at the rental had loosened me up, because I never respond to the text from Harry, and most of all, because she couldn't tell me what to do or where to go. I pulled out my phone and took a quick snap, the light catching the rock salt on the rim just so. The people, the bartender, the oak bar, and the cinder block walls blurring into nothing but darkness behind it. I opened Instagram and wrote my post quick as I could before I could stop myself. When your girl's trip goes awry and you find yourself stranded, at least there are margaritas. I tagged it Catskill, New York. I tagged it Eamon's Bar and Grill. I tagged Margaret, and I didn't tag Diana because she wasn't on social media, wouldn't even allow her face to be there, not when Brandon could be checking. As I hit post, my stomach tickled with excitement. Harry still followed me on there. Harry was bound to see it. I lifted my glass and clinked it against theirs, holding back a hopeful smile. All right, ladies, let's drink.
Yay! I wish we were in a deep auditorium and you could hear everybody clapping. Green light, yay! But also,
I was thinking how this thing, how that scene in the book feels so foreign right now in the pandemic. It's like packed, like bodies and like sweaty, everyone
smells. It's like,
I'm just like, wait, that's a thing that happened? Like, it's just, it's wild. So anyway.
I love that scene so much, and you meet all these interesting characters and somebody ends up making out. It's just like, if you are missing that as people deep into the whatever fifth wave of this pandemic, I cannot recommend this book enough. But beyond that, more generally, I just am so excited that I get to host this because I loved this book. You know it. I read it in many iterations back in the day, but I just find it so twisty and engaging, and it has so much heart and just tons of like really great details and moments and emotions and action. So those of you who don't have their hands on a copy yet, absolutely get it from Greenlight. You will not be disappointed. It is just a psychological thriller of the highest order. And I wish you could hear all of us like clapping for you at Greenlight in person right now.
It's very funny to just read into the void.
Yeah. But, yeah. It's weird.
I'm imagining it.
Deep in your mind. I can hear that.
I see someone clapping in the chat. So there we go.
Thank you. Clap hands. The first thing I wanted to ask is just, can you tell us a little bit about the origin of the story and like where you got the idea for this twisted tale?
Yes. So a couple things. So we my husband and I were driving to Bonnaroo, and it's like a 15-hour drive, which Andy actually knows because she did it with us once. That's a side note. But this is not the year that she came. And we were driving, and it's like 5 or 6 hours into our drive, and the car breaks down on the side of the road. And we call AAA, we get the tow, and they tow us to Stanton, Virginia, which is like the cutest town on earth. And like, if you could like serendipitously, like, or in the Matrix, like design where you want to break down, like you want to break down here, like there's a presidential library, it's completely walkable. You don't need a car. We didn't have a car. There's like beer gardens. And so we're walking through this like cute downtown and the main strip and stuff. And there's like a train store and a vintage bookstore. And then we go to buy like razors or something at the, like this little deli. And the girl behind the counter is like, oh my God, you should come to this party tonight. Like inviting us to hear like the local band. And we didn't actually go to that party, but the whole thing felt so charming and idyllic that it was almost creepy. Like, it's like, mm-hmm. What is wrong with this town? Like, why is everyone being so nice to us? Why is it so creepy? Like, or why is it so charming? Is it even real? Like, how do we manage to break down like exactly on this mile on the highway? And so I just started to think like, what if a group was trying to go somewhere and they wound up somewhere else? And it was like, had a similar vibe. Like everything just felt really like cool and fun and kind of like, oh, let's make the most of it. But then something went terribly wrong. And then my second story is when I was on a bachelorette weekend for a dear friend, Blair, in California. We were all hanging out and one of the girls goes running and like discovers that like the bachelorette weekend was like next to some secret society. And it was like, we read the whole Wikipedia page and it was really wild. And it was like kind of a cult or like kind of like the Illuminati, like it was like a lot of powerful people. It was very strange. So there are actually no cult elements in this book, but that got me thinking of just like truly like a girl's trip gone wrong. Like, how wrong can it go? Like, what could happen? Like, just what happens when you take this thing that's going to be this wonderful, like, little escape you have together where you're like, let's just get out of the city and have fun. And then just, I mean, everything that could go wrong goes wrong, but also in unusual ways. Like, there's a line in the book where a character asks, what is this, the Twilight Zone of exes? Because the people that the girls are trying to like kind of get space from, because, sorry, worth mentioning, they're all going through breakups, keep showing up in this town. So it's like, what is really going on here was kind of my like driving force for the book.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely like that uncanny valley feel. And it's just very relatable that like when you're with friends and you start out with all this like happy anticipation and joy, when things go wrong, everyone would do exactly what these women do. It's like, okay, let's make the most of it. Let's still go out. Like, let's still make this a good, like, you all have that friend that's like, come on guys, it's not ruined yet. And so I feel like that's very understandable, but actually something I really loved and that kind of becomes a theme and plays into the story in a big way, as you mentioned, is that this group of women, all are sort of bonding over the fact that they're going through breakups. It almost has this like young first wives club feel, even though they're not all necessarily, you know, divorcees or anything. And so I'm curious where that element came from and how you decided on that.
So I thought there was something so interesting about putting a bunch of divorcees, or they're not actually technically all divorcees, but generally putting that in Brooklyn, because in the like just Brooklyn social scene, a lot of people get married later or don't get married at all. So it felt like almost like weirdly, almost more shameful, like to be divorcees in Brooklyn, because it's just like, it's like everyone else is just like still dating and you already like have this kind of past behind you. Obviously, not that it should be shameful at all, but I think it's actually like almost more unusual because less people are getting married. So therefore you have, you know, whereas maybe in other places where people are getting married right out of college, you know, they're getting divorced in their late 20s and it's not so uncommon. So it kind of was like, I just thought it would be interesting to like explore these women who get together kind of not in this like Sex and the City way to like talk about how hard it is to like, you know, deal with the New York City dating scene, which is its own thing, but to kind of experience the fallout from making a really traditional choice in a not so traditional place and then seeing how it didn't work out, and just like unpacking that.
Yeah, I love that. And when you start with so much of this, like, you know, these sort of dark underbellies of emotions, you know, they have shame and they have embarrassment around it. And they have, you know, potentially trauma from like making this traditional choice that didn't work out. And then that all really, you have a lot of like material to play with when it comes to these characters and all of the events that spring out of it. We just heard.
I just wanted to add one thing is that I wanted to show that the different relationships ended in very different ways, because I think a lot of times you like in TV shows and whatever, you just see like, oh, there was infidelity and like that's the whole that. So I wanted to like use the different women as ways to show the different ways that relationships could fall apart.
Yeah, I love that. And that felt very different from a lot of, you know, thrillers and domestic noir and like, you know, stuff that we see in this genre where all the characters are really multifaceted, and also all of these sort of relationships feel very true to life and complex, and like it really rarely is as simple as like, you know, the man was a dog and he cheated and that's why they broke up. Like, there's just so many more interesting backstories, and there's a lot of sort of secrets and betrayals that you play with throughout as well. If I haven't said it enough yet, everyone who is here tonight, you should be buying this book. You're going to love it. It's so good. Something we were lucky to hear from Sam's voice. She is one of our narrators in the sample that you read us. And I know from reading a very early copy of this that there was a draft where Sam did the entirety of the narration. And as those who have maybe started it now know, we hear from both the perspective of Sam and of Margaret, one of the other, you know, two women in this trio. So I was hoping you could just share a little bit about that evolution and why you brought her voice in.
Yeah, so I started the book based off this idea that like basically it was like Girls Weekend gone wrong, and these people wind up in this town and then one of them goes missing. And that's what I had pitched to my publisher, and they kind of all signed on just from like this paragraph. And then I'm like, oh, I actually have to go write this. But so when I pitched it, it was just going to be just Sam's voice. And then I got pregnant right around the same time. And I ended up going through this very difficult pregnancy experience where it was basically to do with some prenatal testing that revealed some potentially very scary things. And then none of those things actually came to bear out, but like it was just this months long process of trying to figure out kind of what was going on, you know, with my body, with the baby, with everything. So I felt like in this very weird and scary limbo, and I had completely stopped writing. Very depressed and Googling and anxious and all that. And then when I got out of that, when I finally got some answers and could kind of like move on with the pregnancy, I like try to go back to this book and I'm just like, I cannot just write about this woman who is, I think at the time, now she's like in the final thing, she's like 30, but at the time I had her even younger. And I was like, I just can't write about this like 20 something who's like sad about this like guy who left her. Like I just was not feeling fully like that was where I wanted to be. So I really expanded Margaret, who had always been a character and always been a big character in my mind, but I just never thought that she was going to have her own, like her full own narration of the chapters. And I really expanded her. And then I expanded her backstory to include a story that was very similar to mine. It does diverge because what happened to her ends up being very different than my outcome. But she has this pregnancy trauma in the book. And that is part of what really rocked and kind of maybe was the first domino that kind of broke up her marriage. And I just thought that was, I don't know, like part of it was just truly processing my own trauma and like figuring out how to like write through it. Cause that's all I do is cathartically write and read through things that I'm going through. So part of it was that, but also, you know, kind of speaking what we said before, the different ways that relationships can be affected. And I thought that was so interesting, like two people who like wanted a kid, like where it felt like they had everything going and then this experience happens to them and they can't get back to where they were before that. And I just really, really wanted to kind of explore the ramifications of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's really interesting with the timing too, because I knew about this like backstory of yours with this prenatal testing. And then I think it was this week or last week that big,
yeah, it was like came out Saturday or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was like, yeah. For anyone who doesn't know, New York Times did this big piece on non-invasive prenatal testing, which is this kind of Silicon Valley thing that is very common. It's just getting more and more common every year. So even if you had a baby like 6 or 7 years ago, they might not have pushed you to do it. But in the last like 5 years, especially, most OBs are recommending it. And it's just for certain, it's basically, it's one of those things. It's kind of like a PCR test. It's extremely sensitive to anything. So while it's good because it can tell you a lot of, it can provide a lot of information based on a blood test, where it's bad is it finds all these markers that aren't necessarily true. So the Times did this expose where something like for rare conditions, like 80% of the tests are wrong, which is
85.
Crazy.
It was, I mean, positive tests, 85 of those people will not actually.
So that's what I had, like, I had found it out on my own by doing my own research. I found some statistic because what they were screening, my daughter for was a very rare thing called monosomy X. And I found that you're actually like, it was something like, if you get a false positive, it was like a higher chance of getting a false positive than it was to like have this rare disorder. Like there's more false positives from these tests for that than there are, because it is so rare. So it was just, it's really crazy. And I'm not like, I'm certainly not against any kind of testing. I think information is good, but I do think that what needs to happen, and I hope it comes out of it, is just a lot more explanation to women and anyone who's pregnant about what these tests mean, and not just like a, oh, it's routine, because that's how it was presented to me. It's like, oh, we just do this, it's routine, you're not a high risk, it's fine. And that's, in the same way, that is what happens to Margaret, with a very different outcome though, because in Margaret's case, her baby actually does have the condition, and that is part of a lot of things that happened to her. But what I really could kind of step into through her character was just that feeling, that months long feeling of not knowing and feeling very out of control with something that was happening in your body. And I think that is something that, regardless if you've been pregnant or what, I think a lot of, you know, women especially do feel sometimes like their bodies are not controlled by them, or some people don't want to let them have control of their bodies. So I needed to like write that. And now I'm really glad I did, because I think it's going to just get more and more talked about. And even when I have just been sharing it, I have had people being like, oh yeah, this happened to me too. And you know, you just would never know, because people are, it's not the thing you like announce on Facebook, like, oh, hey, I got this really scary test result. You know, you just, when I announced my pregnancy, it was just like, oh, hi, we're having a girl. So it's, yeah, I was really happy to kind of be able to explore that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm really glad that you took on that topic, and it really adds a lot of depth. And it's interesting now. I can't imagine the book without both of their perspectives, in large part too, because it does such a different thing with the narrative when you're switching back and forth between two people's minds, and they have different information, different experiences, different things that they're sort of digging up. So can you talk a little bit about, adding in a whole nother character, and did that open things up for you, or excuse me, adding a whole nother narrator, like, did that open up a lot of possibilities for you, or was it like this back to the drawing board of like, how am I going to present this story now? Was it challenging?
So I had written two narrators before with one of my YA novels, Love and Other Trainwrecks, and it was really fun.
Fight a green light.
Yeah, please fight a green light. It was really, really fun. And like, I loved it, but I also was like, I'm never doing this again. Like, no way. Andy, you've written multiple, so you know. Like, you're like, once you finish it, you're like, I'm never doing it again. So I was actually really hesitant. And my editor at Putnam had suggested, like, oh, is that something you want to explore? And I was like, I really don't think so. And then, of course, find myself there. So yeah. And then with a mystery too, you are, at least with Love and Other Trainwrecks, it was a pretty straightforward, it was a 24-hour story about two kids who meet on a train that breaks down. And also, I apparently have a thing with, you know, car and vehicle breakdowns. I don't know. I didn't realize that theme was throughout my books, but here we are. And, but yeah, so that was a very tight thing. And it was like a contemporary romance. So it wasn't a mystery. So it did feel like a bit overwhelming to be like, oh, hello, here is all the beats and points of my mystery divided into two different people. And she has to say this, but she knows this. So the reader knows this, but the other character doesn't know this. And I think when you do write a mystery with two narrators, you naturally have a lot of dramatic irony for the reader, which can be really fun and engaging, but then but there's a point, right? Like, it can be annoying if the reader feels like they know way more than the characters know.
Yes.
So it was a lot of balance. And then I think, you know, as anyone who's done it, and even people who've read books like this, I do think the hardest part is to get the voices really distinct. And that is just like something that you're kind of like, you keep editing and editing and editing. And there will always be things you kind of missed, but you do your best. So. But now I will say that I'm never doing it again. Like, it has been done. I'll do it in four.
On the record.
Four more books. Recorded. Maybe four books from now, I will try it again. But like, not anytime soon.
Is it like giving birth where you're like, a while later, you're like, it wasn't that bad, was it?
Like, no, it's not, Andy. It's the opposite of that. It's like, I remember how bad it was. Like, I don't have a biological imperative to forget. Like, I truly remember I'm not doing it again.
Okay. Noted. You heard it here first. I did want to talk about like your twists more, because I think my blurb for this book included something like, this author puts Hitchcock to shame. Like, I think you are really known. Those of you
which is for the record not true at all. Hitchcock is flawless, but well, you know. But I'll take it, Andy.
I am very impressed. This is also very true of Leah's adult debut, All the Broken People. Like, whether you love it or hate it, like, people keep saying, wow, that is a twisty book. And we are like zigzagging all over the place. And I think it's thrilling and so well done. And every twist is very earned. And so I was just hoping you could talk a little about how you pull that off, maybe selfishly. I know you're a plotter. Like, how do you actually keep, you know, playing with our expectations and pulling off just twist after twist?
So I didn't actually realize how I did it until very recently when I was writing a Q&A for a site, and it was like, what's your tip for writers who are writing mysteries? And I realize now this is, so The Perfect Escape was my second thriller, but I'm just doing revisions on my third thriller. So I have basically three under my belt now. And I'm realizing that the trick is, if the twist occurs to you first, it's going to occur to the readers first as well. So whatever it is that you think of, just don't do that. So like for my first book, I had to like write whole drafts through it where I'm like, oh wait, I got to change that. It's way too obvious. But now it's kind of like part of that muscle. It's like, oh, okay. I have a set of characters. I have a whatever. Who would do this, or why would they do this? And then you think of a reason, and then it's like, okay, but dig deeper. What's a different reason? Like, what is, like, we've seen that, we know that, you know, I think readers, especially in this genre, but in all genres, but I think especially here, are like brilliant, and they get everything. They're eagle-eyed, they see it all, they guess it all. So I think you can't just kind of, it's weird, like, I don't necessarily go with my first instinct. Like, I have it in my head what a certain twist or reveal is going to be, and then as I write it, I realize what needs to change, and that kind of is what like draws things together. And I think that actually makes it, allows you to have a little bit of a surprise, because you can still do all the seeding and the hints that are building up to it, like the Easter eggs. So when you look back, it's like, oh, they said that, and they said that, and they said that. But you kind of know that you are, you know, there is some misdirection.
Right. You kind of become, go ahead.
No, just for me, it helps to have like thought through all the scenarios. Like, I could be writing towards this reveal, but I'm actually going to write towards this one instead. So you kind of like yourself have been through what all the characters will be thinking and what the readers will be thinking too.
Yeah, I love that. It's kind of like you become this like chess player where now instead of having to actually play this way to learn, you can look at the board and be like,
yeah,
okay, like this 5 steps this way. Okay, no, we're not doing that. Okay, 3 steps this, okay. Like,
yeah, you run through the different like moves basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it still has to work, right? And it still has to follow the rules. And I think chess is like a great analogy, because like you can't just like make a pawn just like zoom across the board. Like, they get to go to one step, right? So I think you're still working in the rules, both of your own world and both of just like what we expect from a thriller and from, you know, a rich history of like mysteries being written and filmed. So you're still working within that, but you have to kind of like, you got to play that game a little bit, I think.
Yeah. And something you do really well that I love, and I try to do with my characters too, is that your books are always populated with really smart women. So stuff is never surprising to them because they're dumb. And in fact, they're actually like thinking the things you would be thinking of, like, like, why wouldn't we check this? They think to check that. It's not just like dummies later are like, oh. And you have in this book, especially this really fabulous female detective who is like one step ahead of them throughout. And I loved that. You're sort of, it's this cat and mouse where like everyone is sort of equally matched in intellect. And that means all of these twists and surprises and reveals really are earned because they're not just like whipped out because people acted stupidly. I mean, people act stupidly in lots of ways.
They certainly do.
As that scene that we heard from the reading may have, you know, prefaced, people still act stupidly, but they are smart people.
I think there's like a bit of self-awareness. Like even when Sam is doing that, like she knows it's terrible for her. Yeah. Like she knows that she is just like walking into the lion's den by trying to like facilitate a meeting with her ex who treated her very, very poorly.
Yeah.
And she knows that. And I think, you know, some people will find that unlikable, but realistically, we don't all always do what's best for us because if we did, then we would be robots. So
yes. You know. Who among us?
And especially in matters of the heart, it's like you can have, you know, all the logic in the world, but you know, the end of the day, kind of do what you want to do.
Yes. Well, and in the field of thrillers, I don't think I would want to read a book about law-abiding citizens who make every responsible choice. Personally, that's just me. I'm going to ask one more question, but I also want to flag that in about 5 minutes, we will start taking audience questions. And so everyone who has something they want to ask is welcome to open up that Q&A chat. It's a different chat from the chat that you're already using. Open up Q&A and let us know what they are dying to ask Leah. I'll be fielding those in a couple of minutes. But I wanted to ask a little bit more about your process. And I think a lot of people at these events just like hearing about how a book comes to be. And so can you just sort of walk us through the broad strokes from the time that you have this idea, you showed your editors one paragraph, like what takes you, how do we end up with the book in our hands?
Right. So I do make outlines. I have actually, I'm looking at it now, but you cannot see it, but I have a big whiteboard and a big bulletin board with color-coded note cards and all kinds of just silliness there. And so I go like more like the FBI profiler route where it's like, oh, the strings are tied here and here. Yeah, yeah. I have to see things and put it out. So I do a lot of that. I do a lot of just like thinking, or, you know, this inner commentary while I'm running, walking the dog, playing with my daughter, whatever, exercising, running for me. Like, it's like the whole plot. I just go on a run and then it's like, oh, there's the plot.
I get a text after that's like, I solved my whole book.
Andy gets a lot of texts that are like, hello, this is what I solved in the last 30 minutes. But yeah, so I try to do like a lot of simmering and you know, note carding and putting stuff on whiteboards before I actually write in earnest, just because that's what works for me. But then that said, I always plot. I mean, because I think a lot of times it's like, are you a plotter or a pantser? And for those who aren't in writing circles, pantser is like you fly by the seat of your pants and you just write. And those questions always think, I don't know, I feel like sometimes there's this idea that if you're a plotter, you like, you know, you like etch the plot into like tablets and, you know, Moses comes down and you're like, this is what it is. No, like you change it, like you're constantly changing it. That's why you have a whiteboard. That's why you have, you know, note cards on a bulletin board that you can move around. So I do change it with every kind of revise, but I like to have, you know, the beats there. And my agent is here, Elizabeth, and she can just attest that things change a lot sometimes, especially for my first book. So yeah, I'm a plotter, but you know, I give myself leeway.
We're all plantsters at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly.
End up somewhere in that spectrum.
I think we need to talk though, before we go to the Q&A, do you think we need to talk about plot doctoring, TM, which is the Leah and Andy way of writing books, which is where one of us sends, because we are writing friends, but we were regular friends first, and we live only like a 10-minute walk away from each other. And so we send each other like emergency texts, like, I need a plot doctor session. And then we just like go on a walk. Yeah. And then like go on a walk and just like talk through all the stuff. And I'll be like, okay. And then this happens. And Andy's like, yeah, but why would she do that? And I'm like, stop it with your very logical questions. Like, can't you just believe it? And she's like, no, I really can't. And then you're like, okay, all right. You have to, you know, we got to do this and we got to do that. And we joke about it, but I think it's super, super valuable because we don't have coworkers, and we, you know, like, it is helpful to just be able to bounce ideas. And I think in publishing, like, that's what editors are doing. They're talking to their colleagues, and, you know, and then a lot of writers are just like off in these, you know, we have this vision of, you know, Virginia Woolf and a cabin and
room of like,
right. Yeah. So I think that's, you know,
I think it's
part of the process.
And you're talking about the part where I'm just like a naysayer, but you skipped over the really magical part, which is that for both of us, like, it's so much easier to riff and come up with new ways of thinking about a project that's not yours. Like, it's so fun for me to work on Leah's project and vice versa. Yeah. And like, I would say a good percentage of the time, like, one of us describes the problem and the other person, because we're coming in without preconceived notions, like, here's the answer within it. And by the end, we're like, well, you solved it. They just go to this then, right? That's what you just said. And you're
like we had a recent one for the book I'm working on now where Andy was like, oh, so that's why she was at the bar on Thursday. And I was like, she wasn't at the bar on Thursday. What are you talking about? And I was like, wait a second, but why couldn't she be at the bar on Thursday? I'm the author. Like, I can highlight that paragraph and change it in Microsoft Word. And it was just, it is awesome to bounce it off someone, because their mind is just going to like the most easy and logical place, where sometimes as an author, your mind goes to the most convoluted place because you're so close to it. So yeah, we do have a large history of solving each other's book problems and life problems and all of that, you know,
all of the problems. Everyone needs a Leah. Yeah. We don't call it life doctoring, but maybe we should. There's like plot doctor 911.
It definitely happens as well. So, you know, it's all part of it.
There is some of both. Yeah, absolutely. It is a key part of the writing process. Well, I'm going to start jumping into these awesome questions that have already begun to pour in. Please continue adding. Christina, thanks so much for being here. Let's start with her question of, what are you currently reading and any recommendations?
I am reading The Other Black Girl, which is awesome. It is like Get Out meets, what is it? Devil Wears Prada. And it like really is like, it is those two things that have met, and it is just kind of like bonkers in the most fun way. So I'm currently reading that, and I have just like a full on TBR right now based on all the awesome books that came out, honestly, on my pub date, because you're like very aware of everything. But the one, the couple ones that I'm like super excited about are School for Mothers or something, where it's like this dystopian thing where the government teaches women how to be mothers. And I'm just like, I love that. Right. And then I was just listening on WNYC today about, I think it's called Olga Dies Dreaming. And it's about these two siblings from Sunset Park. And like, there's a hurricane, like, it sounds amazing. So I am going to be reading those two books as soon as I get them delivered to my Kindle.
Amazing. Kate Dietrich. Hi, Kate D. We love you. Has a great question. When you have multiple characters, how do you craft their unique backstories, personalities, etc.? Do you draw inspiration from people you know, people in pop culture, people in other literature, etc.?
So I really try not to draw from people I know, because I think when I get too close to life, first of all, it's a great question. But when I get too close to life, I feel a bit trapped, and I find myself that I'm actually less creative because I'm thinking about what the person would do instead of what the character would do. So I try to like divorce that as much as possible. And if anything I'm drawing from life, it's like a big amalgamation of like all these different people I know, or types of people I've seen, or all that. I don't like sit down and craft backstories. They just kind of, I think they come on those runs. So those are just like, I mean, they don't appear totally fully formed, but I don't ever sit down and think like, what's this character going to be? Like, I just kind of, I have an idea of who these people are. And I think even though I write super plot driven thrillers, character is really important to me. So I kind of like, I almost do more creation and craft around the plot, and the characters are kind of just there and I like throw them in. And yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's difficult. I think one of the most like crafty thing I do with it is I actually have a list when I'm editing about all the different words and phrases the different characters say, because you just don't want the voices to be too similar. So like, for example, one of them would say like just a lot, but like the other one like never says the word just at all. Like I truly delete all of that away. So I think that's like kind of the biggest like editing thing I do, to just like try to really, really get it so these characters are not
distinguish
sound like they're talking, you know, because it is tricky, because I write things that are very like interior and mental, and so it's like you don't want them to like, it sounds like they have the exact same thought processes. That's kind of the trickiest part.
Yeah, definitely. I love this question from Isabella del Rosario. How do you stay confident in your writing? Basically, how do you know when something you have written is finished?
Okay, how do I know? I'm going to shout out Elizabeth one more time, my agent. Usually she tells me when it's okay. She's like, it's ready now. Before that, she's like, it's not ready. I'm just like, okay. How do you stay confident? I mean, it's so hard. This is my 7th book in the grand scheme of things. It's my 2nd thriller. There's no easy like confidence pill you can take for writing. I don't think any of us, you know, Andy like hit the New York Times bestseller list this year. And I was like, okay, is your life different? Did it change in every way? And she's like, no. I'm like, okay. You know, like I think there's no place that you get or amount of good things that happen that can really kind of make you feel like, oh, I cracked writing. But I think that's kind of the joy of it too, is that you're always getting better and you always have more to learn and more to aspire to. So I think for me, it's less about feeling like, do I have confidence? And more just about finding a project that I feel like I'm going to learn from, and it's going to be a challenge to me, and I'm going to enjoy that challenge.
Yeah, it is back to the blank page every single time. All right, I'm going to try to move more quickly so we can be sure to get through these. Jill has an interesting question. Leah, do you still act as a book doctor for others besides Andy? Yeah, Leah, do you?
I do. I actually have a business called, it's called newyorkbookeditor.com is the website. And I actually am a developmental editor on the side too. I don't take a huge amount of projects on because I have a lot else going on, but I love to work on commercial fiction, and especially women's fiction, and obviously thrillers. So yeah, if you are interested, head over there and you can find all the information.
Yeah, if anyone's looking for a developmental editor. A great question from Jane Gordon. Is it harder to concentrate writing a book with an active toddler running about versus the books you wrote before Eleanor appeared?
Yes. I mean, yes and no. I think I got to the realization some point this fall, probably when she started to be like running everywhere all the time, that I cannot work while I'm watching her. So they're both jobs. And if I'm like, you know, if I'm watching her, that is my full-time occupation at the moment. And if I'm writing, I'm writing. So I just have to separate them as much as possible.
Yeah. I love that. A question from Carl, who is a writer himself. So I love this question too. He says, I loved the book and I'm fascinated how writers express their worldview if you read between the lines of their stories. What part of your worldview did you get to explore with this novel?
Oh, Carl, with the stumping questions. I love it.
I mean, asking about theme, we're asking about message.
I know. So, okay. I'll just, the caveat is that I'm a firm believer that whatever anyone wants to take away from the book is what they can take away from the book. And it's like out of my hands, and readers get to do that. But that said, I think my worldview is that is really coming out in this book is that there are a lot of flawed women, and women are not allowed to be flawed in the way that men are. And so I am going to show women messing things up and getting in their own way. And yes, we have, you know, there's a murder plot, so they mess things up quite a lot, actually. But I think like what's there between the lines is that like it's okay to not be perfect and to not be good at everything you're doing. And that doesn't make it mean that you shouldn't be doing it. Just because you don't always do it right.
Yeah. I mean, it might make you unlikable, but doesn't mean you shouldn't fit.
I think if anyone put like their thoughts that are going through their own heads onto a page, as we do for our narrators, no one would be likable.
Who like, what readout of someone's mental,
like,
you
who
know,
has, like, who has like Pollyanna going on up here? And it's just like, oh, the nicest, you know. I'm sure there's a few of us, but I don't think, especially these days, I don't think any of us would be likable if you just like pulled that
right, whole head transcript, open. Yes, the transcript of their thoughts. Elizabeth's question I'm going to come back to because I think that's a great way to close. Jane asked, did you take a lot of local day trips from upstate for colorful inspiration for accurate scene locations for this book?
Yes. So I live upstate part-time and I live in Saugerties, which is about 20 minutes away from Catskill. I really wanted to do Catskill because I'd already done Woodstock, which is very close. And I love doing Woodstock for all the broken people, but I wanted to go in a different direction. And what is fun about Catskill is it's just like truly like a strip of downtown. Like it is very, very small. It's not like a lot going on. And I just thought it was just kind of the perfect place for them to be like, feel like they're stranded.
Yeah.
So I went up there a couple times, but a lot of it is also just based on kind of the beauty that's around me and Saugerties as well, because it's all part of the Hudson Valley.
Yeah. Yeah. And you really capture this location that's like remote and yet only a few hours from the city. And there's kind of townies and there's people from Brooklyn and it really captures it well. So again, everyone should buy this book from Greenlight. Helen, hello, show it please. She says, when you write dialogue, knowing of course where you're going with the scene, do you listen to your characters? Like, you know where they're coming from and the reasoning and motivation, but you actually let them speak and they give you the dialogue to a point.
And congrats, Andy.
And congrats, Andy. This is so interesting. Thank you so much, Helen, for being here.
Yes, so definitely do it that way. I write all of the dialogue in my head. I mean, I write almost everything I write in my head before I start typing it. Usually a lot of times I will like stand up and just like pace the room for a minute and kind of listen. And then I'll just try to like jot it down as best as I can. But I think especially with dialogue, I don't like think, what are they going to say? I just kind of think, I don't know. Dialogue is something that I don't think about a lot. I think it's always kind of come a little more naturally to me. It's not one of the things I have to like work on a ton.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's definitely like a musicality to it. And like you hear the different characters.
I think it's because I'm just so good at eavesdropping on other people's conversations that I've been training for this my entire life.
There you go. Like, you know, all led to this. Chrissy. Hi, Chrissy. She says, this might be like asking a mother to choose a favorite child, but which of your characters has been your favorite? And I just really quick want to say, Chrissy, which of your children is your favorite? I'm just kidding. She has twins. They're adorable.
I think, you know, for this book, I think Margaret is my favorite. I usually don't have a favorite, but in this one, Margaret, just because I really feel for her with what she went through with her pregnancy. And yeah, girl after my own heart there.
Yeah, you really feel her whole journey. All right, let's end with this excellent question from Elizabeth. Can you share a little bit about what you're working on next?
Yes. So I'm like I just finished a revision. I just sent it to my editors like 5 days ago. I'm so excited. But basically what happened was had a baby in real life, couple months of, you know, newborn, and then the pandemic happened and all kinds of stuff you know, that was just like a crazy time to have a child. And on top of that, I'd had a very traumatic, unexpectedly traumatic birth where I had an emergency C-section. It was very scary. And all of that kind of just led into like, I don't know that I would say I had, you know, full on like clinical postpartum depression, but I definitely had this feeling of flatness and disconnection in the first few months after I had Eleanor. And it was so just like, there was such an intensity to it that I hadn't felt before. And I was like, why didn't anyone tell me it was going to be like this? And, you know, it just felt like kind of crazy. And so when I came out of that, when Eleanor was maybe about like 5 months old and we were still deep into the pandemic, because we still are, I started writing, and these like 70 pages just kind of came out of me about this woman who has a 6-week-old baby. And kind of the hook is that she's dealing with postpartum depression. She's got this newborn, and her partner is like, they're talking one night, and she actually opens up to him and she says like, do you ever wish that we didn't have the baby? And he's like horrified. Like, he's like, how could you say that? We love her. And he's like, you need some sleep. You don't sound like yourself, please. Like, why don't you go to the guest room? I'm going to do all the feedings tonight. You know, you rest. And then she wakes up at 3 a.m., baby's screaming, like poopy diaper, writhing in the bassinet, and her partner is just gone. And so that's like the whole premise of this book. And then of course it unfolds into, there's a mystery and why is he gone? And there's other like characters in town, things are happening. But I thought like, that's just kind of like, when you're in that intensity of new motherhood, it is very isolating. And like, to lose the person who's supposed to be there doing it with you, I can't imagine anything more terrifying. So I was like, what if you wrote a thriller about that? And that's what I did. So I'm super excited about this book, because I think it's just like really, really, again, like kind of like when we're talking about the pregnancy stuff, I think a lot of times we see postpartum depression portrayed in a very specific way. And I think there's so many ways it can come to light. And I just like want to really normalize that. And, you know, and I think there's lots in there too, for people who aren't mothers. It's not like you have to, you know, feel that there is like a solid mystery and all that, but it's my postpartum thriller, and I'm very excited about it.
Amazing. I'm very excited about it too. So that one's coming out in 2023.
But we don't have like a title or a date set, but I will be, you know, but you should buy that one on Greenlight too.
Yeah. As soon as that one is
in a year,
Greenlight's the place to go.
Thank you both so much. This was such a great conversation. Clearly from the questions, you know, folks were so eager to hear more from you both about the writing process. Loved hearing plot doctors, that you're an FBI agent with plotting. Learned the new expression, are you a plotter or a pantser? amazing. Yeah, but I think this is what our readers always hope for in a book event, is to learn how to write their own mystery novel. Thank you Absolutely. So much. Thank you so much. This is a great conversation. Thank you all for attending tonight's event. Please, please support Greenlight Bookstore and Leah and Andrea. We carry both of their books at the store. Leah will be signing, and so you can get signed copies of her newest book, The Perfect Escape, with that gorgeous poster in the back. I don't know that she's giving out the poster, but you know, you can buy the book. You can buy it on the website. You can buy it in the store. Thank you both so much for this conversation, and we will see you next
time. Thank you so much, Greenlight. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.